Okay, now you can probably hear me, I'm guessing.
Yep, everything sounds good.
Okay, there's a lag. I'm going to start counting, and when you hear me, you let me know. 1-1000, 2-1000, 3-1000,
I hear you.
4-1000, 5-1000. There's a 6 second lag.
Yeah, my Wi-Fi is having trouble for some reason. I'm having trouble connection, so I don't know if anyone can hear me.
I can hear you fine.
Okay, I just got back in. My video is down because of the same Wi-Fi
Right, but
lag.
yes, everybody, we're doing sound checks and
there
stuff
is a
because this
six
is the
second
first
lag.
time the skeptics here have been on this side of the broadcast on a live
Hello,
point. Don't worry, we'll get started in 30 seconds. All right, and welcome to another edition of Proselytize or Apostatize. I'm your host, David Russell, along with my co-host, David Paulman. What's up, David?
How's it going, Russell? Good to be back with another episode.
Ah, yes, sir. Today, we're going to be talking about divine hiddenness. Now, guys, we weren't planning to do this live, so excuse if there's any technical difficulties or anything like that. But we have skeptics and seekers here, David Johnson and Andrew. So why don't you guys just say hi?
Great. I'll say hi, David Johnson. Andrew's not actually skeptics and seekers. Andrew is still unbelievable in proscenium.
Yes. So say hi, Andrew. I know you got like a 6 second delay, you said? Well, that's more than 6 seconds.
Yes, very laggy on my side.
Yeah.
You just got cut off.
Yeah, I'm having connection trouble too, as you might can tell. My video is blank, and so that's part of a connection issue. So I'm going to try to soldier on, but I will say, just as public service announcement, kids, when you don't not doing something live, Zoom works almost every time. Zoom. Go on with the show, Russell. We may or may not get Andrew, because I think there's something wonky about what this particular service is doing that Zoom does differently. Because we just did a show and it was rock solid, and so we will try to soldier on and do our best. If we talk over each other or we are talking as if we're not hearing each other's arguments, it's probably because we're not. So
probably if it gets too bad, we can always end the broadcast. I mean, it sucks, but it may have to be that way. So we didn't expect this. I sure didn't expect having issues that I had with OBS and Skype today. So we'll soldier on and try our best. Guys, the topic today is divine hiddenness. And people like even my inoculator here, David Johnson, thinks it's probably bigger than the problem of evil. It's probably the most hard to answer issue for Christians. And that's what we're going to talk about today. So I wanted to open the floor up because we know who David is. And Andrew, I don't know if you've been on the show before, but if you have, we just want to welcome you if you haven't. And would like maybe just to tell us a little bit about what you do and, you know, your Still Unbelievable podcast in Proscenium. Yeah, I think he's
okay.
Still
well, issue. First, thank you for having me. I don't think I've been on before, but you and I. Yeah, like I said, I'm suffering. Well, that was about 4 seconds. So I have not been on before, David. You and I have done a couple of podcasts together over on Skeptics and Seekers. So thank you for having me. Yes, at Reason Press, we run two podcasts at the moment. Still Unbelievable, which started as a response to Justin Brierley's Unbelievable show, but it has branched out since then. It's primarily an atheist and Christian sort of forum where we discuss religious topics. But the other show that we do, Proscenium, is not primarily religion at all. We address world politics, cybersecurity, you know, whatever comes to mind there. It's much more a variety podcast on the order of something like Mindscape. So thank you for having me. I appreciate being here.
Awesome. And David, why don't you just tell the audience oh, David just dropped out. So yeah, Divine Hiddenness. The whole reason I wanted this podcast to go on is kind of like a extension of the one we had from Skeptics and Seekers. So before we do that, David Johnson, why don't you tell the audience a little bit about what you do and why you do it.
Yeah. So I do Skeptics and Seekers. It is a blog/podcast. I say blog first because I care more about the written than the audio. The audio is just kind of a fun thing. The audio and video, the podcast part. It's a fun thing that I do after the fact, but I really care about writing a good argument. So if you're one of those guys who's too long didn't read, I'm not writing for you. I'm writing for people who actually care about getting into issues and care about the written word and doing that. And then the comments on Skeptics and Seekers, skepticsandseekers.squarespace.com. I care much more about the comments than I do about the show because I want to interact with people. And the show helps to spur better conversations. But the conversations are actually in the comments. And so I care about what people say there. It's very important to me. And then, you know, the podcast is where I can get together with a Christian and yell for an hour and have a nice relaxing drink afterwards. So
yeah, and then the Christian has to do this. So. But no, you know, it is a fun show, and you know, I wish I could have I could prepare a little bit better for it. But with all the things going on this month, it's been kind of crazy. We're going to have a new captain soon at our job site. So that's exciting. And it's been crazy all week because of it. So, yeah, our payroll's going to be strewn through corporate now. So a lot of personal things going on. So excuse me if things get a little bit crazy today. David Paulman will be presenting an argument. No, I'm just joking. He didn't write it out. He shoot from the hip too. So, but yeah, we're going to be talking about Divine Hiddenness. Now, David and Andrew, what is the contention with Divine Hiddenness? You know, there's the popular argument that we get from J.L. Schellenberg, but what avenue do you guys want to attack this from? Because I know there's different Divine Hiddenness arguments. So let's start there.
Can I start?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I've been on the show Unbelievable twice, one of the times with Andrew, but I've told Justin privately, the show that I really want to do on Unbelievable is my own argument, which may be a spin off of Schellenberg, I'm not sure. But my argument is the fact that there are ex-Christians at all is an incredibly huge disconfirmation of the Christian claim, disconfirmation of the God claim. There should be no one, especially someone who has been a Christian, who comes away thinking, you know, maybe there is no God. And so I think part of the hiddenness argument, where this takes off from the hiddenness argument, is that everyone who wants to know that God exists and wants to then begin forming a relationship should know. It should not be a game. And if you've been on your knees for years in your life and you are still finding that God is hidden or shrouded or whatever euphemism you want to use, and you can't get to him in a confirming way, no matter how hard you seek, then there is a problem with the proposition there is a God. At least that there is a God that cares one way or the other. Now, there could still be a God who just doesn't care. But if there's a God that cares and wants to be known, and he's hidden from people who are looking, that's a massive disconfirmation.
And this is probably one of, you know, the biggest issues you
have.
Yeah,
it's Schellenberg's argument.
What's that, Andrew?
I think it is
John Schellenberg's argument, in essence.
Yeah, partly.
I was going to go over that argument, just the deductive argument, so we can actually hit it all.
So I just take it a little bit further than Schellenberg, as an ex-Christian, and as there are millions of ex-Christians, there should be no ex-Christians. So Schellenberg's argument is good for the person who's never known God, but for the person who has been in there, there should never be anyone walking away thinking that there's no God. That should be impossible.
Now, you know, this conversation is stemming from a past conversation that me and David had, and you can find that on Skeptics and Seekers. You can also read the blogs. I wrote a response blog to David, and Andrew responded to me, which was cool. I would love to actually be able to write some more, Andrew. I'm sorry I haven't been able to get back to you, but I want to hear from Andrew too. Why don't you give us a little synopsis of why you think this is a big deal? He just
we just lost him there.
Yeah, before we go, Paulman, do you want to respond to what you just heard real quick before I go into anything else?
Well, I thought you might want to give the syllogism, because a lot of the premises are uncontroversial, and so I think if you spell it out, we'll see that there's really two premises that the theist can reject in the argument. And as for myself, I think a rejection of either of those premises is defensible. So, I mean, you know, I'm open to sort of two ways of responding, at least to Schellenberg's argument. And but I think it'd be better if you lay out the argument before I discuss possible ways of responding to it.
Okay. So before you do that, Andrew's back. And so maybe we can get,
are you saying that there are no, Andrew? Right.
So Andrew, I asked why you think this is a big issue.
Well, okay. So I think we can start with why I think it's a big issue, and with Schellenberg's argument at the same time. So we can start with, do either of you think that there are non-resistant non-believers who would freely enter a relationship with God?
So I'm open to that possibility.
Yeah, I would be too. So okay. Yeah. Go ahead, Andrew. I know you're on a 4-second delay.
All right. So then the second premise of Schellenberg's argument then is that if there were a free will, if there were an all-loving God who was also powerful enough to make himself known, then he would by necessity do so to any non-resistant non-believer. And because there are non-resistant non-believers, and if there were a God who was loving enough to enter into that relationship and does not, then there must not be, and this is the important conclusion. So we're only talking about one kind of God in Schellenberg's argument. Must therefore not be an all-loving personal God who is capable of bridging that gap. So Schellenberg is not saying that there is no God, just that the personal all-loving God is excluded by his argument.
Right. So guys, here's how the syllogism goes from divine hiddenness. If there is a God, he is perfectly loving. If a perfectly loving God exists, reasonable non-belief does not occur. Reasonable non-belief occurs. No perfectly loving God exists from 2 and 3. Hence, there is no God. Do I have that right, David?
Yes. Oh.
That's only one formulation of Schellenberg's argument.
Yeah, I was trying to give a quick one, quick syllogism.
I'll post into the chat.
So Paulman,
that I got out of his book.
Paulman, what do you have? What did you think there?
Well, so you've got kind of two ways you can go at this. The first is to deny the first premise that if there's an all-loving God, then reasonable unbelief would not occur. That seems to be the more popular one that most responses to Schellenberg, they seem to deny that premise. And so they'd say
I may have misheard the premise, because I thought the first premise was if there's a God, he is an all-loving God. That's what I would deny.
Sorry.
Because logical form, just speaking in logical forms, as I understand it, I'm not a logician, but that doesn't hold. If there's a God, he doesn't have to be a loving God. There could be all kinds of gods. And so I would disagree with the premise that if there's a God, he's a loving God. I'm not sure how Schellenberg would make that leap.
Well, I'm pretty sure you could just modify the argument then, because most theists aren't going to want to defend the existence of an evil God. So you could at least modify this to say that the sort of God.
If there is a loving God, if you just put that together, if there is a loving God, then move into whatever the next premise is. Okay, I can do that.
Sure. Right. Yeah. So it's pretty easy, I think, to modify the argument to make that qualifier there. Was it the second premise that is the one that says that if there is an all loving God, then reasonable unbelief does not occur?
Yes. Second.
Okay. So sorry, my mistake. That is the one that is the more common one to be rejected. And so you have various ideas that'll come into play here about how you could have reasonable non-belief occur even if there was an all-loving God. And so you've kind of got responses such as at best all a person can say is that God hasn't revealed himself to me yet, but you couldn't say that he never will. So that might almost seem like a skeptical theist response on that one, but that's one way of denying that premise. Then evidentialists like myself
I don't think that works particularly well.
Oh, go ahead. I was just laying out what the theist options here are, but if you want to give a response on that, that's fine.
Oh, no, I don't want to interrupt you. I'm sorry. I couldn't tell if you were finished. And so please lay out the case, because I think that's better for the show if you get to finish. So I'll try to hold my horses.
Sorry. Yeah, I was just saying that that's a possible way of that some theists take to respond to that second premise. Other theists, evidentialists, tend to deny that third premise, I believe, is the one that says that reasonable unbelief occurs. And so they would say, well, no, that doesn't happen. God has not left himself without a witness. His existence is clearly seen through what has been made. And so, no, anybody who doesn't believe in God, they're not being reasonable in that. And so those are kind of the two broad ways that theists respond to the argument. And obviously there are those aren't like monolithic responses, so you've got some different ways of nuancing it within that, but those are the two basic camps that theists fall into.
And the final lap is been passed there. So, yeah, I don't know whose car that was, but that was a race car.
that was me. I race in the house from time to time. I fire up the Lamborghini.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Okay, so Andrew, go ahead, man. I don't want to, you know, I'm sharing the mic here.
I appreciate that. So I think the problem is that the way Schellenberg defends the second part of his proposition, and I'm about to post into the chat the version of his argument that I'm using. I think the problem is that the way to defend the second premise depends on the fact that an all-loving God would at any time T be willing to reach out to a non-resistant non-believer, some person S, at any time T that this person was open to a relationship with God. An all-loving God And an all-powerful God, in the sense that the God could reach out at any point, would reach out at any time the person. While I understand, David, I understand your rejoinder. I don't think it works against Schellenberg's argument particularly, because a non-resistant non-believer that is open at any time should expect to find an all-loving God at any time that person is open to it. Otherwise, I don't think we understand all loving in the same way.
Okay, and just real quick, Andrew, there are three Davids on the show. This is going to get confusing real fast, so you might want to go Russell, Paulman, and Johnson.
That's why I said.
Or David just Paulman. Or just Russell, Paulman, John. Russell, Paulman, and David. That would work too. The right of age.
I did say David Paulman. So if you're having trouble, it's because I did say David Paulman. So if you're having trouble, you've got to listen to me better.
He's having old man syndrome here. So.
Yeah, I think you cut out a little bit here and there. So there'll have to be some real clarification on that, because I almost jumped and I thought, wait a minute, there's another David. No, there's another David. Was it the other David or the other David? Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. I will do better. I'll take it on me to do better.
All right. So, so you're going to post the argument in the chat. That's fine. David, do you want to come back on that
I'm
at all?
I'm posting it right now.
Which David do you?
Paulman, my bad.
Okay, good. Here we go.
All right. Yeah. So,
by the way, hello in the live chat. I've never done live chat. So,
yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah. Cool. Travis and Travis and Apostolatize and Virginia Apologetics Union and Travis and StreamYard. Who's StreamYard is the thing here. So we have, it looks like us in the chat. And yeah. Maybe someone
you
else.
Got the private chat and the live chat. The
yeah, comments. Now
so
I'm going to be
guys. Apologies for the formatting. Yep,
I am putting it into the live chat too. So
yeah, no, I'm going to be now fixated on the chat to see if anyone in the chat says something, and I probably won't be listening. So I've officially zoned out. Go ahead, Paulman.
All right, so that seems like something that the theist would be entitled to reject. Why should it be thought that we would have to accept that at any time that someone was open to God or being open to a relationship with them, that God would of necessity reveal himself?
I would like to actually agree with you,
Paul. Well, I'm not making an argument. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I agree with you, Paulman. So I rejected the first premise that Russell gave, which doesn't sound necessarily like how the actual thing goes. I was reading the chat of what Andrew posted here, but I would, for logical reasons, reject the second premise too, the same one that you would suggest. I do not believe that being all loving means that you also have to reveal yourself. So there may be some reasons why we as humans, for instance,
that's not the argument love, that Schellenberg's making though.
Right. But I just want to give the ground that can be given. As a human, there are, you know, I might love my child very much, but in some kind of superhero logic, you know, I've got to protect my identity and I've got to protect my children. And if I had a relationship with my children and let them know me, it would put them in danger. And so I have to save them by keeping them in ignorance. You know, you can come up with a scenario where someone who is all loving still isn't powerful enough to make himself known in a way that wouldn't create harm. And I think that Schellenberg's argument, as stated with the premises that we went with at the beginning, that doesn't necessarily follow. So I, that wouldn't be my argument. My argument would only come into play if God is not only all loving, but also all powerful, and also that the happiness of our immortal existence depends on knowing him. So you've got to throw some more things into the premises before it fully makes sense to me. And I think these are things that Christians just assume that are in the box, but just the premise as it's stated isn't strong enough.
Right. I'll let Paulman give a quick response on that one, and then I want to give it back to Andrew before we move on to the second part of this.
Well, I don't think I have much of a response to give because David Johnson was more or less agreeing with me. That wasn't exactly the route I had in mind for rejecting that premise, but as long as we are in agreement that one can reject that premise, that an all loving being would necessarily reveal himself to anyone who was loving at whatever time that person was open to being in relationship with God, that seems to me an eminently rejectable premise on the part of the theist. And so I think it needs further defense than whatever, you know, than just saying it needs a more robust defense. But I'll turn it over to Andrew.
So let me take Schellenberg's argument the direction that he would take it. So this is in his 2015 book. I'll try to post the title of the book into the chat so that you guys can send it on to your viewers. So what Schellenberg says is that if you accept the all good, all loving God, there should be no good outside the relationship with God that is deeper than the good that can occur inside the relationship with God. And if there is no good outside the relationship with God that can be deeper or meaningful, more fulfilling, and more to God's desire than the good that can occur in that covenant, then it must necessarily be the case that God should reveal himself to any person that is non-resistantly willing to enter into that covenant at any time that person is willing, because any good inside the covenant with God is better than any good outside.
I think that's a very important clarification, and I just want to say I agree with that line of argumentation wholeheartedly. The original line of argumentation, I think, left a lot of room to disagree with, but I think that line doesn't.
All right. So, for kind of my thoughts on that is, why should it
this
be
is Schellenberg's defense of proposition? Oh, sorry.
No, you're good. Yeah, so I'm thinking, why should it be thought that there is no good that couldn't, correct me if I'm not phrasing this right, but why should it be thought that there is no good that couldn't happen outside of that relationship? I mean, not like ultimately, right? So obviously, ultimately, the good is going to have to occur within the relationship with God. But couldn't it be thought that it couldn't be... trying to think what the word is. For whatever reason, it wouldn't be best for the relationship to occur right then. So maybe God would have a good reason for having the relationship occur at a later point. In other words, maybe God would have a good reason, and this seems logically possible to me, that God would have a good reason for entering relationship with that open person, but at a later time.
I don't think that really works for
me. I think that's already
me.
Been addressed. I think you'd have to defend what that could be. Oh, I'm sorry, David Johnson. Go
no,
ahead.
No. So look, I know that you're on a delay. So when I hear you talk, just ignore what you hear coming across the mic. I will have stopped talking to let you go in to make this work. So this is the only time you can make me stop talking. By the way, so enjoy the privilege while it lasts. I think that the Schellenberg argument, the most recently stated argument, is I don't see a flaw in that. So if you're saying, yes, but there could be some good from not being in relationship with God that might then express itself fully in a later relationship with God, I think that argument fails to the basic necessity of what we think of as a relationship with God as the ultimate state of being. And so you would have to make the case then that being in the ultimate state of being for less time is better than being in the ultimate state of being for more time. Okay. And I think that's the problem with objecting to that.
Right. And I get that it will be helpful if we can give some kind of hypothetical where that could be better. But are you then agreeing that that's not strictly something that's impossible? It's just not something that you see how it could be the case? Because I think this is an important point.
I think it's logically impossible. No, I could be convinced.
Where's the contradiction?
Well, I could be convinced that I'm wrong, so I just want to say that. I'm not a philosopher, and so right. If someone wants to find where my weaknesses are and come on my show and beat me with them, you can do that with deep philosophy. This is about as far into philosophy as I can get. But that said, when it comes to ultimate joy and ultimate fulfillment, more is less. So once again, this is kind of a barroom philosophy here that I just don't, you would have to convince me that that's not true somehow, that more good is not as good as less good.
Andrew had something to say, I think.
Well, I'll try to... say something, then let you guys talk because I want to keep the lag interrupting the show. But thank you for offering the mic to me. So I think the problem that I have, Paulman, with what you say is you talk of ultimate good in regard to being in a relationship with God, that once you're in that relationship, that is the ultimate good. And you say that there might be some point in time at which it is not the ultimate good. So there is some point in time in which this God that is the ultimate good himself says that it is not ultimately good for the creature to be in some sort of beneficial relationship with him. And that seems to me to be the kind of that has to be resolved. And the second part of this is that is that is sheer speculation, intended to back up hiddenness, which is the problem that you're trying to address. And so I think that you've doubled down on hiddenness in a way that is the show we're attempting, we're attempting to resolve hiddenness, and you're appealing to hiddenness.
Okay, so a couple thoughts on that. So first of all, and hopefully I can keep all this in my mind, but when we're talking about ultimate, I don't really like to talk about like what's ultimately good, because there's going to be distinctions here about ultimate with respect to what. So what might be ultimately good for me might not be what's ultimately good overall. So while yes, ultimately the good for me is to be in a relationship with God, it could, if there's conceivably, if there's a certain point in time where it could help a ultimate overall good, if I'm in a relationship with God at some particular point, as opposed to, you know, being in it as soon as possible. So I think what you'd have to show is that for an overall good to be achieved, then it's important that everyone be in a relationship with God as soon as possible. And I think there are really good reasons to reject that assumption. And then, oh goodness, the other point you brought up was, oh right, so trying to back up the issue. Well, it's not that I'm trying to, I guess it depends on what you mean by address hiddenness. What I was trying to show is that Schellenberg's argument does not entail its conclusion, that there are ways of rejecting these premises, that we don't have to accept that there is no good God. And so all I would be trying to say is that hiddenness at this point is not incompatible with God's existence. Now, whether you consider that a resolution of it or not, I'll leave that to individuals to decide. But all I was trying to establish is that there is no necessary contradiction between the two. The point I was trying to make before was, and this is kind of where I wanted to push Johnson on, because I think he said it was incoherent to think that there was any way to conceive of God not revealing himself to a person the first time that person is ready to be in a relationship with God. It seemed like he wanted to say that there was something incoherent about that. And so I kind of wanted to push him on, where's the contradiction in saying that God could have a reason for revealing himself to someone who's ready at a later time than the first, you know, moment where that person is ready? Why is that an incoherent idea?
Well, the problem for me may be linguistic, but it's Schellenberg's use of ultimate good. And so I think definitionally we need to agree, is being in relationship with God ultimate good? If it is, then you're saying that ultimate good is not good all the time. And that's what's incoherent. Now, if you say that being in relationship with God is not ultimate good, by definition, then I think there's room for your argument to proceed. But otherwise, it's just a contradiction in terms to say ultimate good is not ultimate good right now. So if we could have ultimate good for 20 years, that would, you know, all 20 years, that would be worse than if only some people had ultimate good for 20 years. You know, I'm just not sure how it seems like we need some other word other than ultimate good, because if it's ultimate, it's ultimate, and you can't then argue that less ultimate is more ultimate.
Yeah, that's one reason I don't really like the terms. Like when I'm arguing with presuppositionalists, they're always like, well, what's your ultimate authority? And I'm always like, I don't like using the term ultimate, because it's not a particularly precise term. So, you know, what I would say is that there is going to be maybe a maximal overall good, right? That God has an overall plan, which as an Arminian, I would say is to see as many people as possible freely saved. But then with respect to any particular person, well, what's the best thing for that person? Well, it's obviously that they would be saved, but it's not clear to me that as long as the person is saved in the end, it's not at all clear to me why it should have to be as soon as possible, particularly if particularly if there's some reason for God to delay revealing himself to this person, because that's going to do something in that person's life that is a prolonged, God prolonging the hiddenness for that person might do something to that person, which will ultimately help them to bring more people into the kingdom. So that seems possible to me. I don't see anything that's wrong with that. And so then, as long as that person is saved, well, what you were calling the ultimate good for them, that is still accomplished, but more good, right? So for that overall good, better things happen in the end for the total number of people who are ultimately brought to Christ because of this prolonged state of hiddenness for that particular person. So that seems to me to be at least a possibility for why a person could honestly be seeking God, and yet God could not reveal himself to that person.
Is that an unjustify the means argument?
It
sounds like an ends justifies the means argument. So I'm going to deny an individual ultimate good because I can do something even better if I make them suffer longer.
Sorry, Andrew, you had something to say, right?
Yes, this sounds to me like redefining evil. Yeah, just very, very quickly. This sounds to me like redefining evil as good. And the way that you get to do that is through hiddenness. So let me give you an example. If you and I decided to go out and go on a shooting spree and injure a bunch of people, because we're present, because we're here, people would measure our actions and they would not say, now notice I didn't say we killed them. We just injured them. And no one would say, oh, well, in the end, it was good. And the only reason that you get to appeal to this idea that God must have had some greater purpose in mind is precisely because the God is hidden. But the most telling bit of this conversation is that you haven't offered anything concrete in regard to some person and what happened to them and why it was better than being in a covenant relationship with them. And that is because, as far as I can tell, there's no God out there with an ultimate plan.
So do you want a more precise account? Is that the objection? You want a more precise account?
It would be helpful for me, I know, and I think Andrew is asking too, to give us a picture of how you see this playing out. Because what it sounds like to me, just respectfully, is it sounds like an ends justifies the means argument. It sounds like, you know, God has some very important things to do. And yes, it's going to cause some people to suffer longer than they need to, and, you know, or longer than it seems they need to. And I'm going to keep myself from having the kind of relationship with them that they want right now. But it's going to be better for everybody if I do this. And that to me feels like an ends justifies the means argument. It sounds like either we're not dealing with a completely empathetic God, or we're not dealing with a God that's powerful enough to do the best thing without going through the suffering. And so I'm not sure how to take that unless you put some flesh on that example that maybe I can see and say, oh, that's what you mean.
Okay. So yeah, I'm going to be happy to, you know, give a more detailed account of how that might play out. But maybe first we should address this kind of ends justify the means issue here, because that seems like that's a stickling point for you. Why would that be a bad thing in this case to have ends justifying the means?
Well, if the means are something other than loving, they call suffering, say, then it's like a mad scientist who says, you know, I'm going to take this group of humans and I'm going to experiment on them. Now, I'm going to come up with COVID, a cure for COVID, but these humans are going to, you know, I'm going to grow a third eye on one and I'm going to cut out one's liver while they're awake. and another, I'm going to do some things. They're going to suffer horrible pain, but we're going to have a cure so fast, and I'll stitch up these humans later, and they'll be fine. That to me sounds like possibly a competent God, but not a particularly loving one. And remember, our premise is that we are dealing with an all-powerful, all-loving God. And so ends, you can't have an ends justifies the means when the means are not loving to have that all-loving God.
Okay, so let me give then another kind of a counterexample to that is how do you feel then about, you know, if let's say just like discipline in general, right? So you could take this in the area of children or in the military or just, you know, in the government or whatever. When you have people who, you know, for whatever reason, they break rules, they break laws, then at least, and I know there's going to be some controversy about this, but normally it's not thought to be completely unacceptable that you will punish that person in such a way that, you know, so that you'll have a better end result, right? This is why parents will, you know, punish their children, and however you might do that, it does seem that there can be times where even pain can be something that is done lovingly. And I mean, so that seems relatively disanalogous from kind of the one that you're giving, where it seems like rather arbitrary to like cut somebody's liver out while they're still, you know, conscious and such. You know, that would
seem we do this all the time, except just substitute mice for humans. So it's I'm just making the example a little bit more visceral say that you're doing this thing to create this result, and everybody's gonna like this result, but you know you gotta break a few eggs to make omelets. That's mobster logic. It shouldn't be all loving God logic. And I would say that the example you gave about punishment, yeah, I could answer that, but I'm gonna bypass that because I think it does go a little bit off course. God is not punishing the non-resistant non-believer, unless you're saying that he's punishing them for something by not showing himself to them and leaving them in a less ultimate relationship. I don't think you're saying that he's doing that as a form of punishment.
No, I wasn't.
So I don't understand that particular example and how it relates.
Well, I was just giving an example of sometimes how we do seem to have an end justifies the means mentality, even when we that involves inflicting pain on people. So,
well, I actually would, if you want me to comment on that situation, I disagree with that. I don't believe that inflicting pain as a way of making someone better is a legitimate line. So I think that there are ways.
You got your COVID shot today,
right?
So you're suffering.
the COVID shot is not a punishment. And so if you're saying, well, that person did something bad, and I'm going to hit them until they hurt real bad, that's not, in fact, a thing that I would agree with. So, and furthermore, I would say that the things that we humans, as limited as we are, to control other humans in a way that gets them to not behave in an insane way, we're much more limited in the options that God has. So remember, he's not just all loving, but also all powerful. And so if what he wants to do is stop me from punching you in the face, he can do that without inflicting pain on me and without allowing you to suffer pain. I, on the other hand, if I wanted to intervene and stop Andrew from punching you in the face, I might have to punch Andrew in the face. Right. So, but that's a limitation of the kind of creatures we are, that those are disanalogous when we're talking about an all-powerful, all-loving God.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I would agree with that. Kind of what I've been presupposing here is the more Arminian view that God is interested in preserving the free actions of people. Right. Because, I mean, if I wanted to go over to the Calvinist view here and say, oh, yeah, well, God will just do, you know, whatever he wants, then, I mean, I can reject the whole hiddenness argument because in Calvinism, God doesn't want everyone to be saved. So there are some people God just doesn't love them, doesn't want them to be saved. So if we're going to go over to that kind of a view of God, then the hiddenness argument goes out the window with it. If the hiddenness argument is to even be a problem, then I think it has to be within an Arminian, or at least a broadly free will sort of theism. And so on that, then there's not this kind of God can just, you know, use his power to do whatever, because no, in under this sort of a theology of providence, God is going to be working with the free choices of people as well.
Exactly. And I agree with that. But remember, the Schellenberg argument of hiddenness is that you've got a free person who is either seeking God or who is open to God. So this is not a person who is using their free will to run from God or to ignore God. This right. is a person who's using their free will to accept God if they knew that God was there. And so, again, it's kind of disanalogous, and you're going to have to give a little bit of a real world analogy that shows how making that person suffer is good for everybody.
Yeah, yeah. And so that was the other part of where I kind of wanted to go with that. Let's take a person who they want to believe that God exists, right? They're open to believing in God if God would just reveal himself to them. And they aren't in any sense, you know, feeling a relationship with God. They're not sensing a nearness with God or whatever. But the person, you know, is persistent. And so, you know, they turn to becoming a studious person, right? They start studying. They become a much more well-read, much more intellectual sort of person. And through that study, they discover all sorts of reasons to believe that God exists. And then eventually God does, you know, come to them in that personal way that they had been wanting in the first place. Well, we had that time in there, though, where, you know, why did God make them do all that studying, right? Why didn't he just, you know, reveal himself to them right away when they wanted him to? Well, then let's say a few years down the road, the person, is actually able to be a help to other people because of this additional research that they've done, right? Maybe people who aren't so much interested in, like, just, feeling a presence with God, and, you know, people who are more of an evidentialist mindset, then he's also able to help those sorts of people, right? And so here, this seems to me to be at least a possible sort of real world scenario where you've got somebody now who, by, you know, God not revealing himself to that person immediately, that forced the person to become a more able defender of the faith and a more able help to God's people overall. And so, like, let's just say as a result of that person's ministry, right, in the end, like, thousands of people come to Christ who would not have been believers apart from the ministry of this person, and they wouldn't have been able to do that had they, just had that relationship with God right in the first place and never, you know, felt the need to actually study the issue out in any kind of, academic setting. That doesn't seem impossible to me. And so theoretically, then there could be people like that. Do you see
your camera's on, Andrew? Sorry. Andrew, your camera's on. I know that you do not prefer that.
It's kind of funny that we've gotten here.
Getting there, thanks.
We've gotten to almost an hour in, and we're just scratching the surface. I didn't even prepare. I didn't expect it to go this way. I prepared a whole different argument here.
Did you not think that I was capable of civil discourse at a philosophical level?
Well, you're not. So you're still not. No, I'm just joking. But we're really still scratching the surface here, though, guys. I guess how I would come at this is I would agree with David. I think there could be.
Thank you.
That God might want to teach you. Yeah, Paulman.
Which David?
I think there could be more good that comes out of you learning from the journey and so forth. I I don't see a problem. I agree with David on this.
And by the way, there's one other thing I want to add to that story.
Isn't that just saying that there is a good that's greater than God? You're saying that someone can learn from the journey. And that's fine as far as it goes. So Schellenberg's proposition is that the greatest good always comes from a personal relationship with God. Now, if you say I don't agree with that proposition, that's fine. But then what you're saying is that there are at least at temporary times things that are better for us than not being in a relationship with God, who at any point in time can give us a more meaningful good. And that seems on its face to be contradictory.
So I would like to jump in before you come back on that poem, because I want to,
with the personal, all-powerful, all-loving God of the universe.
So I want to hear Paulman's response to that, but I also want to respond to Paulman's example that I had asked for. So I thank you for giving the example. I want to acknowledge that, but I find some challenge with the example that you gave. So my first challenge is it does not seem like it is the norm. That seems like a very exceptional example. Not a normative example at all. So we're talking about a person who might go out and be an evangelist for God, and he becomes a better evangelist because he studies, and then he comes to knowledge of God through his studies, and then he brings many people to the knowledge of God through that. But it seems to me that he would be an even more studious person and even more fervent in his evangelism if he had came to the knowledge of God up front. And God said, look, I want you to study these things and I want you to tell people about them. He would have been far more studious, far more convincing, and he would have had that knowledge from the beginning. He would have known what to look for. He would have been able to. So it just seems like a very exceptional kind of example. Also, if people kind of look for God and they don't find him, this is how you set up your example, but he's intellectual, so he goes and studies. It seems like the more likely thing is that people look for God and they don't find him, and then they move on. And then their testimony to people is, well, I looked and didn't find him. It's not, now I'm going to devote some extreme portion of my life studying about this God that I looked for and couldn't find. So I find your example extremely exceptional and not at all how I see the real world working out. It could work that way in 1 out of 100 occasions, but I don't see that as being very realistic.
Well, yeah. And so I think I'm sensitive to the point that you would be making there.
One more problem?
I'll let David respond. Andrew, sorry, just save David that one Paulman thought real quick.
The additional problem is... Okay.
All right. And unfortunately, guys, I'm going to have to be off in 7 minutes here because I do have something going on after this. But I'll just try to be quick here. David Johnson, this seems to assume that the person could have the same motivation if they had come to the knowledge of God at that initial point. But it seems to me that based on, you know, certain types of people, that would not always be the case. Some people would seem to be more motivated if they, you know, did not feel that, you know, they didn't feel this relationship with God, right? Maybe if they felt like a certain absence, maybe that's something that would that they would be like scared of, something that they maybe wouldn't even want to be a reality, and that could very well motivate them to study something as much as possible. So I don't think it would be fair to say that a person would always be just as motivated if they'd had the relationship with God to begin with. Then regarding that it's an extreme case, I mean, maybe it is. I could possibly think of other examples here. That's just, you know, kind of one that I've worked with on this issue. But I think it does at least show that in principle, there's no reason to think that this couldn't be the case for an honest unbeliever. And I'm going to cut it off there to give Andrew a chance to say what he wants.
And in case I don't get to say it again, thanks. Thanks for your time with this. Fallen, you're welcome to SNS at any time. I promise it'll be better than the last time you came.
Okay, so before Andrew goes, I would second that in a way. I think we're assuming too much here. We're assuming how people would react and so forth, and we're assuming too much on people and God. So I think this is a good spot to say, hey, we do need a part two to this discussion. And I would love to continue this discussion with both of you as the as a part of our, you know, monthly talks here every once in a while. And I'm sure David would be able to come back on for those talks after he's not the co-host anymore because he is leaving. But Andrew, I'm going to let you respond because I know you had one more problem to bring up. And we got about 6 minutes here left because David has to get out of here. And I'm sorry that it was only Paulman today that pretty much got the brunt of the questions. I didn't plan it to go this way, but looks like they're interested in you, Paulman. They've already beat me up today, so they're looking at you. So, all right, Andrew, go ahead.
David, let me say as well, David Paulman, thank you for sharing a mic with me. I've enjoyed the interaction. Sorry for the technology frustrations. We'll work it out for the next show. It seems to me that another problem, well, there are actually two problems. First is that, as David Russell said, we're placing a lot of assumptions here. Well, the major assumption is that hiddenness demonstrates that there is a God. I think David Johnson and I contend, as does Schellenberg, that hiddenness is a major problem along the lines of sin and suffering, right, along the lines of evil. But the second problem is, if you say that there are those people who like this lifelong academic pursuit. I am one of them, by the way. I can concede to some extent that you're right, that some people like the journey, right? The problem is that there are plenty of people who don't. And so the problem that the Christian faces is how to be able to tell through the veil of hiddenness
you're muted, Andrew.
Yeah, you got muted, bud.
You might be right. Exist who didn't get the answer up front, and they pursued the answer, and they were, in Dale Glover's words, real seekers, and eventually got the answer. Well, see, the problem is that hiddenness invites the problem of hiddenness is that there's no way to actually tell whether there is a God who is helping someone who eventually will come to Christianity because they enjoy the journey versus that person who actually needs the answer up front. Hiddenness doesn't offer you a way to distinguish between people, and that is the problem of hiddenness and why I think skeptics are saying. Go ahead.
I'm not sure I caught all that response, Andrew. And so yeah, I want to thank you for
David
it.
David R., I'm sorry. Sounded like you had something to say.
Wait, which David?
No. Go ahead, Paulman. You could go.
Yeah. Andrew, your response was kind of choppy, and so everyone's just kind of trying to figure out where to get in. So that's...
I think I got the meat and potatoes of it. It just, yeah, there were some parts where it was cutting out. But so I'll just say, for myself, I do consider the hiddenness problem to be, I like some people say it's an extension of the problem of evil. I think problem of evil is an extension of divine hiddenness. And so I do think divine hiddenness is by far the most formidable objection to theism. And so you're right. You're absolutely right when you point out that we don't have a way to determine for, you know, other people, you know, if they're what sort of person they are, or even why it is that God might be hidden from them. Because we also don't have a way to determine, you know, apart from ourselves, whether we're being honest about that. And so, you know, ultimately, this is kind of, I'm an evidentialist. I really like to like base my belief in like what the evidence for against the proposition is. So like ultimately my theistic belief comes through what I see as, you know, evidence and arguments for the existence of God. But, you know, I mean, I also want to take hiddenness seriously. And you're right, because you say there's no way to tell with people on this. You know, I think I've offered a way that it's at least possible that you could have reasonable unbelief occur even with an all good, all loving God. And so as long as, you know, that possibility remains and I have, you know, other good reasons for believing in the existence of God, it may not be the most satisfying answer, but it is an answer. So I don't think it's an absolute refutation of my Christian belief, though it definitely is a challenge.
Thank you very much for your response there. Yeah, so at the end of the day, you know, I mean, there's a lot of assumption, a lot of speculation here, and a lot of, you know, there's a lot of stuff to it. And I hope to scratch even deeper if we can go into this again, you know, another time. And yeah, so guys, I appreciate you guys being on the show today again. I'm going to have to cut it short here. We are at our hard break for David Paulman and myself. And yeah, thanks again for coming on, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Yep.